Okay, good evening. Welcome to the inaugural show of Building the Scottish State, which seeks to be a week on Thursday show about how Scotland can be different when it becomes independent, which I believe is just a question of time. So I have with me Graham Campbell as my first guest, which I could not think of a better person to have on as an inaugural guest, given the situation which is occurring throughout the world in terms of the protests against police brutality, and also the question of the statues which are up, which many of which who were involved in the slave trade, and to what point we should take this in terms of history, et cetera. But I first wanted to kind of get your angle on Scottish identity. You as a black Scot who was born in London and who has, given your name, I think you must have, Scottish connections or Scottish heritage. And I, as an American who has a Scottish father and like you, doesn't speak with a purely Scottish accent, I still feel very Scottish. When I've seen you at the SNP conference, there is this kind of aura of acceptance and what Nicola Sturgeon has termed, I think rightly, a kind of a civic nationalism, which says that, if you live here, if you are, it doesn't matter what, color you are, if you live in Scotland, you're Scottish, which I perceive as very different from, for example, the English or other, nationalities where you have to, but I wonder, I just wanted to get your take on how deep that goes. I mean, it's one thing at the SNP conference, but how is it in broader Scottish society in terms of acceptance of you as a Scot, even though, you have a darker skin color and your accent is not what you would consider, purely Scottish?
I have to tell the truth with this one and say that I think the majority of Scots generally ask them straight up, they would say I'm not Scottish. They'd say I was not Scottish because I don't have the accent, and they were partly because being black, they think I'm from somewhere else. And obviously because I'm Rastafarian, they know that I'm from Jamaica, or at least that's what they think. Yeah. So that is the presumption that's always meeting me. And the presumption that when I'm coming across people in my daily life, when I'm walking about the city centre, generally speaking, you get people who don't really live in Glasgow who come to visit Glasgow for work and stuff. And I might be the only black person they see that day because they live in the neighborhood where there aren't any black people. And they've just come for their drink from a Friday night or whatever, and they pass you and they say, oh, look at that, it's Bob Marley. Ooh. And they think, I've not heard that before. And it's ridiculous how many times within the space of a few minutes walk between the two train stations, the number of people that will say that to me as if I am actually deaf. But that only happens here. It doesn't happen in Edinburgh when I'm there. It doesn't happen in London. It doesn't happen in other big cities I've been to. It only happens in the city I've called my home for 18 years. So in terms of how I feel about this place, I love this place. I've stayed this long. I didn't plan to stay here. I came to go to uni and join the political struggle, which I did. And I didn't envision myself still being here 20 years later. But it's been a good move. I love this city. I love living here. What it's about. I love the garrulousness of folks, the egalitarian spirit of people. Yeah. There is that in the national identity of Scotland, which I really, really appeals to me, and which I recognise because it's rather similar to how Caribbean people are. I mean, that their sense of humour is rather similar. Their kind of slightly aggressive sardony is quite similar to our sense of humour and our sensibility. So I recognise a lot of traits within the Scottish people that I see in my own people. So I feel at home in that respect. But whether I'm accepted fully as one, in the SNP, of course I am. But it's one thing to say that everybody who lives here is part of the nation, which we do politically. But coming with that must be all the things that we need to do to make it possible to be here, to live here, and to integrate here. We have to be honest, we haven't done all of those things. So on the one side, there's black people feeling marginalized from the opportunities they should have if they were white people, versus the perception of a lot of white people that this is a foreign element in their population. Because if you do that thought experiment, close your eyes and say, and somebody says to you, think of a Scotsman, nobody would think about me as their thought experiment.
Yeah.
And that's the point. Scott is a racialized identity because we are an imperialist power coming from an empire that we were a central part of. Mm-hmm. So, of course, we have a perception of ourselves as just white Scots. Mm-hmm. That's why it was important to do that show, Black and Scottish show, because it showed that actually there are people who've grown up here who've lived here their whole lives, who know nowhere else, it's their home. And they have the accent, they have the culture, they have Perth accents, Inverness accents, Aberdeen accents. They have all of the accents going across this country.
Yeah.
And that's great to hear them speak it, because it's largely tied up, Scottishness, with language, clearly is. And so that's possibly why I feel that many people don't, they will accept me as a Glaswegian. I think if you live in a city and you live in a place, if you're a part of your local community and you're active in it, most people will accept you in it. But whether they accept you as part of their nation, that's another thing.
Mm-hmm. And what do you think needs to be done? I would argue that you would start with a better education about the colonial past that should be mandatory in schools. But if you take someone who is, I don't know, you know, my age, you know, 50-ish, and is sort of set in their racial ways, what do you think can be done with that person? I mean, you have talk about, I don't know, sensitivity training or stuff like that. But I mean, how do you make people understand better what racism itself, how it manifests itself, and genuinely changing people to see things in a different way? And so what do you think needs to, what do you think more can be done in that respect?
Well, on a one-to-one level, I think we all got this on social media where we have friends who make racist comments and stuff, and usually they retweet something that has a racist trope in it. It's pretty clear they don't understand why it's racist. And often the reaction is you press the delete button, the block button, and then you don't talk to them again.
Yeah.
They're your friends, so you're probably the best people to talk to that person, to talk them around. If you don't talk them to them and persuade them around, how on earth is it going to be possible for someone like me to talk to them and persuade them around? But there are exercises we can do. I mean, for a long time, for 20-plus years, anti-racist activists have been doing an exercise called equality listening. And that's an exercise where somebody talks about their personal experience of either being black, being gay, being a woman, whatever it is, being disabled, and gets the floor for 20 minutes, half an hour to relate an experience. And the rules are the mixed group, whatever it is, it's usually mostly white people, they're made to listen to the story, and they're not allowed to ask a question, not allowed to interrupt, they just have to listen to it. Then the person who's relating their experience leaves the room. And then the facilitator works with the people to talk through what they've heard. And the way that works is it allows people to, you know, especially if you do it with a number of different stories being told and they're not interrupted, you then get engagement with the emotional experience that that person has gone through. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of race politics is about engaging with people's emotive reactions to things, their presumptions about other people, and their presumption that of others that they've othered don't have the same human emotions and reactions. When they see that they hurt exactly the same way when people talk mean to them and prejudge them by the way they look or by what people presume their culture to mean, people do understand what that means, but it's to engage them emotionally and connecting with that person's pain. So I think anti-racist education has to start with a sort of element of counselling almost, to just break through the defensive barriers. You always get that thing at first where people don't want to say anything incorrect. But if they don't say anything incorrect, or they don't feel comfortable to say something incorrect, you don't genuinely know what they're thinking. And if you don't know what they're genuinely thinking, how can you anti-racistly educate them?
Mm-hmm. Is this something that you would advocate, for example, in the schools or, you know, from a very early age, talking about that in a way? I mean, you know, because obviously most people are very shaped by their family life and what their parents, the way their parents view the world. And so for older people who may be much more set in their ways, it may be more difficult for children or younger people to break through and see that level of understanding, even though the children are perfectly capable of seeing that as well. But I would imagine that if something like that were proposed on a systemic level, that there would be a lot of resistance. How do you see that just in terms of, you know, instituting this type of education from a very early age among children? Has anything like that been done, or are there efforts to do that on a scholastic level? And if you could just tell me about that, because I don't know about it. So.
Certainly, the anti-racism is taught in schools and taught even in primary school, so it's not unusual. I mean, they talk about it in English language and culture, you know, modern studies, those sort of stuff. So it's certainly taught in schools. But I question whether it's taught effectively in schools. Mm-hmm. I think there are educational materials they use, but the conversations obviously are going to be quite basic in the 45 minutes you've got in the lesson. And I think there's been an effort by Black Lives Matter activists and anti-racist educators, Scottish Association of Minority Ethnic Educators, to produce materials that are more effective for teachers to use that will work. I'm not sure how young people should get this in primary school, but certainly we know that from research that young people pick up race very early on, before they understand the words and they understand the content and the meanings of the words being used. It's pretty clear from the way they do drawings, portraits, crayoning. Very early on, they work out that blonde hair, blue-eyed, and white skin is more valued. Mm-hmm. They quickly work that out. And they quickly work out that darker skin is less valued. And they quickly work out, even darker-skinned kids do it. We know that kids draw drawings of themselves and their parents and themselves, teachers, as if they're all white.
Would that be different in, for example, an African country where whites are very much a minority? Would that have a mirror image in predominantly black nations? Or
it's hard for me to know that for sure, but I would guess yes. I mean, okay. Certainly in Jamaica, I can say from my experience there, obviously all the teachers are black and all the children are black. So of course they're going to draw people black. Yeah. Of course they will. But it's different here, because those kids who are in our schools now, if they're black children, they don't see any black teachers for a start. There was an interesting guy called Bernard Cord. He's an interesting guy in many ways. He was an educational activist in the 60s in London. And in 1972, he wrote a book called How the British Education System, he meant the English Education System, Makes the West Indian Pupil Educationally Subnormal, which was the phrase back then for additional learning needs. What he was talking about was the institutionalized racism, where teachers deliberately, in a racist way, marked down black pupils. And he went through a lot of research. The man eventually actually became the deputy leader of the Grenadian Revolution from 1979 to 1983. And he ended up being responsible for overthrowing his leader. But that's another story. But
he was educated. 83 is when the United States invaded Grenada.
Yes, Cord was the man who did the coup.
I remember in my high school, everybody was going, rah, rah, USA, we beat them. Or I had no idea what was going on. But
before going home to Grenada, he was an educationalist in Britain and in London. And his work is seminal, because basically he did some work to show, even though he was teaching a class of East End children, you know, they had a black teacher. Half of the kids in the class were black, but the black kids drew themselves and him as white. Mm-hmm. And kids are still doing this because there's not those stereotypes and thoughts that they have inherited from their parents, or they're not being challenged. And also the history that they know and are told about is being glorified still as Britain is great and is wonderful. Okay. They're still getting that. While they're still getting that, while it's not contested, that narrative,
okay,
how else are they going to get a proper perspective?
Someone just wanted us to address the issue of the difference between civic and ethnic nationalism. And I mean, because there really isn't, I don't believe that there is such a thing as race. I mean, race presupposes that you're different biologically, other than just having different features on it. So I'm more drawn towards the idea of ethnicity as opposed to race. But what about in terms of nationalism? I mean, because Scotland is not any like most other ethnicities, is not any one pure ethnicity. You have people, you have Celts, you have people coming from Norway and the Scandinavian countries. But how would you comment on the difference between, at least in the Scottish context, the difference between ethnic and civic nationalism in Scotland?
That's such a massive question. but let's say that, okay, we are a non-ethnocentrically based secular nationalist movement, in the sense that we do not racially define who we decide who is Scottish. Scottish is everybody who lives here, right? Mm-hmm. So it's defined on a citizenship basis. But there's no doubt that ethnicity plays a role in the defining of the particular history of Scotland. There's no doubt about that. How could it not, given that we are the centre of an international racist empire from which we benefited, mm-hmm. which white supremacy, and this is the point, white supremacy as an ethnocentrism is a central part of Scottish identity. And it's from the Enlightenment rationalism that was supposedly superior in our philosophical instincts coming from Greece and Rome, whereas they forget about Egypt and Africa and all the learning we got from there. They even use words like academic, which is in fact an Arabic African word. So, you know, these forgettings of where your culture and your civilization are deeply ingrained with us.
Yeah, and mathematics as well. I mean, you know, the Arabic numerals as well. That's another thing that we certainly have gotten from that. I'd like to now shift to the issue of police brutality and, you know, in the wake of the Floyd George murder and the uprising and protest that has been caused in the United States and in the UK. Do you think it's a question of it getting worse, or is it, how do you see the whole situation? And do you think this could be a true turning point in improving the way that minorities are treated by the police?
It could be, but we don't know yet. It's too early to tell. But what's unique about the circumstances that happened in Minneapolis is that within 5 days, uprisings on the streets achieved in 5 days what dozens of uprisings and rebellions over the last 50 years have failed to achieve, which is the arrest and charging and sacking of the officers who perpetrated the crime. Mm-hmm. That's not happened before. And also what's not happened before, it's not unique to have rebellions that happen all across cities and across the state. What's unique is the number of them, the breadth of them, and the fact that many smaller towns, particularly in majority white parts of states that before have been white supremacists, you know, eastern Mississippi, you know, places like that, had demonstrations in support of Black Lives Matter. It happened in lots of small cities all over the United States. That is interesting. This rebellion is different from the, it's like the 60s. It's more comparable to the 60s rather than 1992 and Rodney King. It's far more far-reaching. The circumstances in which the resistance to police violence and racism has occurred is a context that's been around with us for about 15, 20 years, really since the drawdown of American troops from Iraq and Afghanistan, which occurred under Biden and Obama. Mm-hmm. That military surplus gear, where do you think it went? It went into police departments. Yeah. And those police departments use militarized stop and search tactics that they use in Iraq and Afghanistan on the streets of their cities. Now, when you police like that, obviously you will kill lots of people, but also you will get physical resistance, and in some cases armed resistance to that level of violence. What was interesting was that people were brave enough to brave the COVID-19 virus, which again is an obvious overlaying of institutionalized racism, which already existed in America, of another thing on top of that. Obviously, the social economics of black people dictated that they got it the worst. But people were prepared to brave that because the more important urgency was to deal with the police violence. And the fact that people bravely got on the streets despite the level of provocation and violence of the police was unprecedented, and also younger people were dominant within that. So something has definitely changed in America already from that. The fact that they're talking about defunding the police, have defunded the police, and are disbanding police departments, that's news. Right. So that is unprecedented. And the reason why is, in Scotland we have some issues with policing, but at least our policing occurs in some kind of democratic framework and some kind of oversight of the civilian government and the authorities. To some extent, citizens have some say in that. Not enough, in my view. It should be democratically controlled, community accountable policing. But we'll get there at some point. But what's interesting is that the way that policing is done in the States, and you'll notice from New Orleans, it's not properly done. You know, sometimes white middle-class neighborhoods will have their own police force, so they're not paying taxes to pay for the police force in the city that they own their money in.
Exactly. I grew up in Austin, Texas, and we had the Austin police, but just in a much more prosperous neighborhood called Westlake Hills, they had their own private police system. So you would not. I mean, I remember being pulled over there, you know, just as a white kid. Also, I remember my family lived in Baltimore, and my brother lived in a neighborhood, a very prosperous neighborhood that was just right next, just one street over from real, you know, kind of ghetto like conditions. And you would have, the neighborhood hired private security guards to, you know, to patrol regularly just that particular neighborhood within Baltimore that was separate from the Baltimore police, just to make sure that their property was protected. So I saw that firsthand, certainly.
So that's a factor all over the United States, large cities where basically middle class citizens on the suburbs or in these little enclaves within the city central areas opt out of the responsibility for policing costs for the rest of the city. So policing is seen as protect those people from the black neighborhoods that are segregated, economically.
But very close. I mean, it, proximity wise, because when I lived in Austin, it was very segregated, but it was economically segregated, especially because it was most of the neighborhoods were post-war. You had different neighborhoods that, maybe some houses were in the $200,000 range, other ones, but they were very, typical of American suburbs, very uniform, bland, but racially and economically segregated. And a lot of that came about because of school desegregation, where people, for example, New Orleans, where I met, in the city itself, you would have, I live just off St. Charles Avenue in New Orleans, and you have these beautiful antebellum mansions with the streetcars along St. Charles. One block back where we lived on Barone Street, which is wasn't as opulent but very nice, but you go three or four more streets back and you're basically in very lower economic, so it wasn't as economically segregated, and so you and in a lot of the older cities you have much more physical proximity between the affluent and the less affluent neighborhoods, and so that partially explains why you have often separate police for places that are just like next to each other and still within the same city.
But even where you don't have separate police, even where they're governed by the same police, you don't see police using the same degree of violence and intimidation, shooting, using weapons, macing, as you saw on those demonstrations, macing people right in their face. Complete breaches of the regulations for the use of those things, even on their terms, never mind on ours. So the fact that they're prepared to use that level of violence expresses their racist fear of African Americans in particular, but all minorities. But African Americans are a people in that continent who are disenfranchised, disempowered, who are actually less economically empowered than they were 100 years ago. If we were there 100 years ago, these neighborhoods would have had their own businesses, own shops, own economic networks, own banks. They don't have that now. And one of the major exploitations that those communities face is, of course, that they don't have any assets. So people let them cheap money, which has caused a financial crisis before and has devastated these communities.
I think it was in 1922 in Tulsa, Oklahoma, that a very affluent black neighborhood was basically, they just went in and shot him up. I mean, it's just...
And torched the neighborhood, yeah.
I mean, just
they burned down Black Success.
Yeah,
that's what they were burning down.
Yeah, when you learn these things, it's not surprising. I mean, for me, it's not surprising given the history, but it is shocking to see that just people would be massacred for being prosperous and doing well. And I guess they just didn't want it to serve as an example for others. From what I know about the police in Scotland, they're much more, they say that the your mouth is your most important weapon, that the police in Scotland will be much more engaged with the subject, much more verbally, to try to talk them down, to try to talk them away from whatever they're doing. Whereas the first instinct in America is to grab the gun and to put them up against a wall. Has that been your experience, that Scotland, that policing in Scotland?
Okay, there's a complicated set of relationships going on here. There is a culture, I suppose, in Britain that's developed since the riots of the 80s, because they got a bloody good kicking in some of those riots, that the police had to develop different ways to speak to black communities and to speak to black youth. And for a while they did back off, but we've had stop and search for most of the last 20 years, intimidating young people across England and Wales. We've had it to some extent in Glasgow, particularly targeted at the Asian communities, along with things like Prevent and other strategies aimed at supposedly countering terrorism. That experience has not quite been the same in terms of the degrees of violence and degrees of beatings and killings, but there's no question that Scottish police have acted racistly towards our community. And daily, the lot of people that I know in my community, I'm talking about the African community here,
yeah,
who drive cars, every one of them has been stopped.
Yeah.
Stopped and asked for a producer. Every one of them. That's weird. If you have five or six friends who own cars, it's very highly unlikely that any of them would have been stopped by the police. But all the people I know have been stopped by PC in Scotland. So I just want to say this about the difference. It's pretty clear that that armed violence towards, which is designed to intimidate and to prevent, you know, any danger to the property owners in the wealthier areas, is designed to obviously suppress things. And in terms of Ferguson, that was a good example. If you go there, the hard stop that you saw used against Mark Duggan, in our circumstances in Tottenham, you know, it had, that there had to be an order, there had to be a commissioner's permission to do that, there had to be an okay over the radio, they had to have court orders and everything to do hard stop. But hard stop is routine, it's daily experience of somebody is being stopped for a traffic violation. Hard stop is the go-to tactic.
And when you say hard stop, that means that there is just no
armed police officers stopping your vehicle physically sometimes.
But for no reason whatsoever.
Yes.
Well, okay. Because in the United States, they at least have to have the pretext of what's called reasonable suspicion. You know, you saw.
It's the same as sus. It's just sus with guns, and but sus with guns leads to people dead. And sus is what the stop and search in London and elsewhere is. Now, stop and search is less used in Scotland because there's less public consent for it, partly. But also, yes, police are in Scotland. I've been to Tully Allen, the police academy here. And, you know, they are told, you know, the most important weapon is that. And you have to use talking and eye contact and be able to judge physical body signs, you know, body language to work out how to communicate properly with a person. So you de-escalate. Yes. The taser and all that sort of stuff, and mace is supposed to be the last resort, but it's pretty clear in America it's the first resort.
No, exactly.
Part of London, it's the first resort, particularly when they're stopping and searching black youth. And black youth are fed up with it. They're fed up with it in the States. They're fed up with it in England. They're actually now, as we now know, fed up with it here, even if it isn't quite to the same extent. But it's the same problem. It's racialized policing. It's racialized profiling. It's the state practicing institutionalized racism against citizens as opposed to have equal rights.
And is the way it practiced, is it, because in many places there's the stop and frisk, where I forget the Supreme Court case in the United States, but that was ruled to be constitutional, to, you know, if there was any not even reasonable suspicion, but a hunch basically that somebody may have engaged in some type of criminal activity. But that's obviously been, you know, transformed, especially in New York under Mayor Bloomberg, et cetera, to basically mean that any cop can go up to any usually minority, you know, person and put them up against a wall and search them. And if they find anything, they can arrest them. And often there's been plenty of evidence of instances of cops planting, I don't know, cocaine or something on the person and taking them to jail. A lot of it also in the United States is driven by the privatization of the criminal justice system, to where jails are privately owned and privately run, with presumably even much less rights for the prisoners that they had even under the state system. What is the situation in Scotland with regard to the privatization? Because I remember seeing G4S vans in Glasgow, and one of them saying, I remember, like, prosecution guaranteed as a logo on the side of the van, and I found that completely frightening. And I was just wondering, to what degree in Scotland have the police been privatized?
None at all, as far as I know. Okay. You're talking, that's the prisons. I don't think privatization is really a relevant discussion around policing in Scotland, if I'm dead honest, because most of our services are nationalized. When it talks about moving offenders to and from, or suspects to and from jail, yes, that's privatized, but the contracts for those are negotiated centrally. So yes, there will be some private firms involved in that, but that's because we don't have a national way to do that. But I suppose the important thing to say is, I'm wearing a Sheku Bayo t-shirt. I'm wearing one of the Justice of Sheku Bayo shirts. It would be remiss of us not to talk about that, because I think it encapsulates what Black Lives Matter means in our context. And that discussion we just had about policing tactics, you then talk about how on earth did they end up being used on the streets of Kirkcaldy? And that's why we need a public inquiry into it.
Could you tell me it started by
somebody saying a mad black man was on the streets behaving erratically with a knife. And then a response was sent involving 9 officers, and the degree of violence used in first contact with the man led to his death, his asphyxiation, with 2 large people sitting on top of him. Now, nowhere is that in the policing manual. We know that for sure, because they've received specific training on not asphyxiating their suspects. You know, when they're handcuffed and leg cuffed, you don't sit on somebody's chest, because then they cannot breathe, they cannot exhale. The whole thing about "I can't breathe," which was what happened to Eric Garner, what happened to George Floyd, is exactly what happened to Sheku Bio. You just don't have the video of it saying so. Then this is the thing. It's, why did those cops think that that degree of violence was necessary or justified? And why did the police and justice system fail to take action against the people who did that? You saw what happened in Minneapolis. Minneapolis arrested them, fired them, and charged them. That did not happen in Kokodi. And that's the weird thing. And I'll tell you, there's lots of weird things about it. If you watch the Sheku Bio documentary on Disclosure tonight, you know, there's Channel 4 one, I think, or no, BBC Disclosure, it shows that the family actually had lots of connections with the police. Sheku himself had done youth volunteering and that sort of stuff, and had done stuff jointly with the police. His brother-in-law, Addy Johnson, I know him because I know him from doing, you know, equal rights work in Fife. And he'd had lots to do with police. In fact, myself, I probably had more to do with the police in Scotland than I've ever had anywhere. I had nothing to do with police in London. But here I've found them, generally speaking, more engaged, more community-minded, more respectful. That has been my general experience. But there's also been some really bad ones who really harassed our community. So we've got both of those experiences. Yeah, despite Addy knowing the police sergeants involved in that nonsense that they did to try and cover up the death and tell him the family all sorts of different stories, despite them knowing him, they still treated him that way. And that's the weird thing. Why in that town, in that station, did those police behave that way? And the answer to that has to be connected to racism. We need a public inquiry to find that out. We can't, for legal reasons, by the way, mention any of the names of these officers or do that. Otherwise, you might get a letter from a certain police organization who doesn't like us having free speech about these things.
I'd like to now shift the conversation to the issue of the removal of the statues. And given the very public and the removal of the, I forget the name of the person in Bristol who was taken down as because of his slave trade. I think he was head director of the Royal African Company back in the...
Royal African Company is Edward Cox.
Back in the 17th century. And so now that brings up the issue of who else, you know, what are the other, you know, figures who could have their statues removed because of that, whether it be the Queen or any member of the royalty, the Duke of Sutherland, all of these other people. What do you think about that? Just in terms of the way that there's this kind of hagiography of people, you know, kind of elevating them into this status, which I think is partially a function of the class system that exists in the UK. And what do you think should be the distinction between who is taken down, whose statues are taken down, and whose aren't, even though, given, of course, that no human is perfect? How do you see that, again, distinction between what statues should stay and which one should be removed?
It's pretty simple. I don't think any slaver or anybody with the direct interest in the slave trade should have any statue anywhere in our country or in any of our cities. But I'd probably take a different view on the street names, and partly because I think I don't want to remove the evidence that we are linked to the slave trade. But a lot of people do not know that these street names are the names of slave traders or owners of plantations. And if we remove their names entirely without reference to the fact that used to be named after them for this reason, I'd rather have plaques saying that they were people who owned plantations and who enslaved Africans and killed millions of people. I'd rather it said that so people could understand when they're walking about our city centre just how dependent on slavery our economy and our city centre's development was. People don't know it. And if we remove the evidence, there's a chance that they would do what Glasgow has always done, which is have an organised forgetting, is the term. But there's a tradition of organised forgetting, which was the story about the merchants. How did the merchant city end up being named? Because historians like Tom Devine in the 70s used to write books about the tobacco lords, about mentioning that they were involved in slavery. he's gone 180 degree round now, because now he's pro-independence. He's now recognises that there's a link between capitalism and slavery. So he wrote a book in 2014 called Recovering the Scottish Slavery Past, which recognises what they call the Williams Theory, after Eric Williams' Capitalism and Slavery. So he now, as the leading historian in this country, recognises that Scotland did benefit from slavery and that it contributed to a very large part of the country's GDP during the Industrial Revolution. So in other words, all the industries, all the big landed houses, the shipbuilding, the docks, the warehouses, the banks, the textile mills, all of them dependent on slave-grown commodities. Yeah. So he accepts that. That's what's changed in the perception and in the story of our country, that is now different. We've got evidence to now show that. So shouldn't we put that evidence in the way we tell our street story? Streets and statues and avenues were laid out by slave owners and slave traders when they ran the city. Of course, big white patriarchal men, racists and colonial imperialists, of course, put up monuments to each other, and their descendants raised public subscriptions to put monuments up to them to venerate their souls. And of course they did that. But obviously we're a different country and a different city today. So what does these things mean to us? And I give the Duke of Wellington as a good example. Everybody doesn't know that.
That's the statue of George Square, right?
It's a statue in front of the Gallery of Modern Art.
The traffic.
The cone. The cone, right. Now, I love the cone, and I demonstrated in favour of, at the time, the Labour councillor in 2013 were trying to get rid of the cone and trying to raise the plinth. They were going to spend £25,000 raising the plinth so that it was too high for you to climb up to put the cone on.
That's very good use of public funds.
Right, exactly. We thought that was daft. But it used to cost them a couple of hundred quid a time to remove the cone, because we had to get a cherry picker. Three members of staff would have to go up there and do it. So it was a proper operation. So that was costing us a lot of money. And eventually, when we came into office, we said, no, we're not going to do that. We're going to leave the cone on. And interestingly, the Black Lives Matter demonstration put a black and white cone on top of the wall. Now, that's a classic example where that statue, to a very hateful, disgusting man who opposed the democratic vote for working class people and was on the wrong side of history on that and lost office. He lost the election, the first three elections with working men having some of the vote. He lost the elections in 1834. So that guy was a complete, utter bastard. But he's been completely refashioned because the citizens of Glasgow, with their gallousness, have redefined what that statue means. So I'd rather that statue stays with the disrespect he's shown with that cone on top. And yeah, that is important because it tells you that the people decide what a city's streets are about and for. You know, we did this with Nelson Mandela Place. That's named because of our role in the anti-apartheid struggle.
Because the South African consulate was right there, right?
That's right.
Yeah.
No. So they used to get their mail with Nelson Mandela Place on it. And if they didn't address it correctly, they wouldn't get it sent or received. So for 2 years, they didn't get mail or receive mail. So eventually they closed the consulate. And they used to, the Royal Academy of Scottish Drama and Music was next door. So the students every lunchtime used to come there and protest every day for about 3 years. Every lunchtime. We harassed them out of there, and we recognised and venerated Nelson Mandela. We were the first city to give him the freedom of the city, name a place after him, and there's going to be a statue there. There's a public subscription to put a statue there. They've raised about half the 450,000 they need, I think. They're well on the way to raising the rest. So Nelson Mandela will have a statue in our place. So this is an example of where we're defining. I'm, of course, Mary Barber at Govan Station.
So we've
put stuff up which reflect the politics that we have as citizens now. So clearly this is a discussion that has to happen with the citizens of cities like Glasgow and Edinburgh, where we make a decision about how we choose to remember this history. Because that's the point to me. This is a process. It's not you pull them down, that solves the problem. Because it wouldn't. We would still have a slavery legacy. We would still have a problem with how to remember it. So how do we remember it? It might be that we take statues away and put them somewhere. Prayer have proposed that. The Coalition for Racial Equality and Rights, they're proposing we have a sort of statue graveyard like they have in, say, Moscow for the Stalinist stuff, or in Berlin they have one for the Nazi stuff, right? You curate it in a museum and you tell the story of what these things in an anti-racist context. So it can be done. There's lots of creative ways these could be done, but the public needs to be involved in the discussion. It's not fit for people just to say, oh, I'll put it down and I'll get rid of the signs, and then not have a plan for the anti-racist awareness raising we have to do to convince the public to come along with us on the need to remove it or to change it. So I'm open about whether things could be changed. I'd like to see some streets named after some good black people. You know, I'd like to see Andrew Watson named on the street. I'd like to see Mary Seacole named on the street. Black Scottish people who have a history here. But that's a decision I think that people need to make. But the more important one in terms of naming for me is the very name of the merchant city itself. Mm-hmm. I've always objected. I live in, you know, my house is in the merchant city. I'm not in it now because I'm in lockdown with my partner. But my house is in the merchant city, and I wish it wasn't called that. Mm-hmm. I'd like it called something else.
What would you suggest?
Heritage Quarter.
Okay, sounds good.
Yeah. But it's not up to me, but we should consult the public on that. Because Merchant City, we used that label in the 90s to say, look, we are proud of our heritage of clever mercantile people and traders who built wealth and developed the economy. We were really proud of that. We just forgot the slavery.
So was Merchant City a name that came about in the 90s?
Was it yes, it was a branding that came out in the early 90s based on the book, The Tobacco Laws. You know, Tom's book actually played a large role in people being civically proud of the role of the tobacco lords and the original shipbuilders and all that of it. Didn't mention that the shipbuilders built ships for the South to get their cotton. Break the blockades in the Civil War. Didn't mention that we were on the wrong side on that. Didn't mention that we did have great abolitionists, and we have brilliant abolitionists in Glasgow, Reverend Ralph Ward or Mr. Clarkson, who helped Wilberforce. We have some great ones. But didn't mention the 250 years in which we benefited from slavery before we abolished it. Yeah. So it kind of glossed over that bit.
Well, both my great grandfathers worked in Govan on the ship in the Fairfield shipyard. So, I mean, I'm a part of that as well in terms of my own personal legacy. And so now I'd like to talk to you about what do you think in a constitution and legal system in an independent Scotland that had much more citizen involvement. What in the constitution and laws do you think could be put in to make, you know, to improve the situation for blacks, even though maybe relatively speaking, it may be better for minorities in Scotland than elsewhere. But obviously there's a lot to do. What do you think could be done and concretely to reduce racism and promote greater equality between all people, just basically human beings living in Scotland?
There must be a compulsory change in the curriculum, which makes it compulsory to learn a correct history, which is anti-racist.
Yeah,
that's the first thing. Much of the demands made on the demonstrations and the petitions that I've been sent, there's thousands of people who've sent petitions in about naming and about the curriculum and all sorts, but they all come to the same thing. It's about education. Yeah. What education, what narrative do you tell people when they're growing up in their country that makes them understand what their country is?
What are they currently taught? I've talked to a lot of Scots about that. And normally, like in, for example, me in the United States growing up in high school, we all had compulsory government classes. You know, you learn about the system of checks and
balances. We have civics. We have, modern studies, they call it.
But from what I can tell, a lot of the history is just maybe a few queens and a couple world wars, but doesn't really go beyond that before kind of the glorification of the, you know, of the social structure or the, you know, the, or justifying the social structure and talking about the conquests and the wars. What is taught and what is your vision for how it should be taught?
Well, clearly British history and Scottish included is predominantly about post-World War II stuff, or about World War I and World War II, the wars that Britain won. Yeah. And that still dominates what they learn. We're still doing Churchill, Hitler, and so on. We are learning the slave trade. In fact, since 2004, it has been in our school curriculum to cover the slave trade up until 1807, you know, the abolition point. So people do study the slave trade and the triangular trade. That has been compulsory in school curriculums for a long time now.
Was there slavery the UK itself, prior to the abolition of the slave trade? And was the importation of African slaves to the UK prior to the abolition in what is it, 1830 or so?
This is a kind of, how long do we have? Because I kind of think there's not long I can say in 1 or 2 minutes.
Maybe it should be the subject for another conversation.
It's a conversation you have with Sir Geoff Palmer, actually. The narrative that we normally have is that the Joseph Knight case is the famous case where supposedly Scotland showed that slavery was illegal. But if we look into a bit more closely, as Geoff does, actually, to get a case to the High Court in Scotland in those days, you had to be pretty much a millionaire. You know, who paid for Joseph Knight's case to be taken to the court session? And the answer is very rich pro-slavery merchants. And they did that for one reason only. It was to show that slavery was in fact legal in the plantation states. But you could petition for your to be allowed to be released in Scotland. But actually, what the myth we have is that it made slavery illegal. It didn't. It legalized slavery there, even though it was contrary to our common law here. And that's the moment of hypocrisy. And there's a similar case in England where legalized slavery in their colonies, even though it was completely in contradiction to their law.
What year was that?
I think it was 1772, if I remember right. Okay. 1778, somewhere about that. I'm hazy with dates.
Okay. So we start with the curriculum and teaching a much more lucid version of Scotland's. I mean, I think that also Scotland should learn much more about what the degree to which they were persecuted with the Highland clearances and this what have you, but also their role in the empire. I mean, my grandfather was I have an Indian imperial passport of my grandfather. You know, when he was back in the 1930s when he got citizenship in India, but under the empire. So I know that Scots played a very central role in a lot of the administration of the empire, whereas, you know, to a lesser degree than, say, the English. What do you think should be taught about that could lead to a better, a more accurate conception of what it means to be Scottish, and which would promote a more egalitarian view and less racist view?
Our central problem in this country is that we have two competing mythical narratives. One is the Unionist myth of how wonderfully brilliant it was that we abolished slavery and went around the world and fairly helped develop all those countries we colonized by giving them civilization. So there's that Empire 2.0 nonsense. But equally nonsense is the narrative that many of us in the nationalist side of this debate have, that Scotland is a small, oppressed country which was colonized by the English and is a victim, an oppressed nation, not an oppressor. But that's not the truth. The truth is Scotland is, in fact, an oppressing nation. Scotland is a perpetrator. And obviously our ruling class may have brought themselves into the Union against the will of the majority of Scots at the time. Scots rioted on the streets of Edinburgh against the Treaty of Union, but the majority of the ruling elite were in favour of it because they wanted access to the markets that the English dominated by having the navy and by having access to the colonies for tobacco and sugar. They wanted access to those markets. They'd failed in the Darien experiment, which was an independent attempt to create a colony, and they had the right idea. They, in fact, had the spot on location. They just didn't have the technology to create the Panama Canal in those days. But they picked the right place, but the wrong time and the wrong actual landing site. But they bankrupted the country doing it. So they had to come into the Union. Article 4 of the Union Treaty was the bailout for the Scottish ruling class for the cost of Darien.
Right. That's what I was going to say. It didn't necessarily bankrupt the Scottish government at the time. It bankrupted the ruling elite at the time, which was bailed out by the Treaty of Union.
But obviously lots of ordinary individual, relatively modest income Scots lost their entire savings in that too. And obviously 2,000 people died in the attempts to colonize. So it really did bankrupt the country. So by getting access to the English markets, the Union was created. So the Union is a creation of slavery. Mm-hmm. It is. So obviously I'm for independence because I want to get rid of the empire. The empire's creation, the Union States creation, is based on slavery and the access to the markets for the goods produced by slavery. Scotland bought into that massively. There was no resistance to that except from the odd abolitionist philosopher like Adam Ferguson at Glasgow Uni. Glasgow Uni was an abolitionist institution, Adam Smith as well. The trouble is they took donations from people who were pro-slavery.
And to what degree do you think Scotland is a colony? I mean, they say, well, we had the treaties, therefore it was voluntary. But obviously there are very, very, very different views on this. Do you see Scotland as a colony within the UK?
No, it is a subordinate nation, though. That's quite a different thing. I think we obviously are in the same category as countries like Catalonia, Wales, obviously, and various countries across Europe, which are small parts of nations, multinational nation states. What I call the residual national question, as they call it in the national question scholarship. We are residual national questions which are unresolved from the rise of capitalism, where we haven't developed our own nation states. Now, there are different theories about why we weren't able to develop our own independent capitalist nation state. We could have done that, would have been a possibility, but the political forces to do that, which is usually the bourgeoisie, didn't want their own bourgeois state. They benefited from having the British bourgeois state. They created the British bourgeois state. So they had their state, they just had a multinational state to do that. So that's why we're not independent. We historically stopped being independent because of that, even if the majority of people. No, we were not colonized. They didn't send an army. Yes, they had a navy to make sure of it, but they were always going to get the Scottish ruling class to make a deal. So no, we're not a colonized country. There are elements, obviously, of subordination and political inequality. That's the point. Once Parliament was closed in Edinburgh, Scots didn't really have any say. We were run by Henry Dundas as a virtual dictator for a whole number of years, that man on the statue in Edinburgh. So we had a dictatorship, more or less, for a number of years, sanctioned by the Parliament in London. So, of course, we've experienced governance from London as an act of almost semi-colonial rule, you know.
It's a very fine distinction, because you would think that if having a colony is exploiting the wealth of it, be it personnel or material, where that colony doesn't get any benefit from it, it is ruled from abroad.
Again, but that's not the same. Scotland got a benefit. Scotland undoubtedly was developed as an industrial economy during this period. So there's no doubt that it benefited from it, and it benefited from exploitation of the peoples everywhere else, because what were Scots doing? The very Highlanders who were cleared from the Highlanders and from lost at Culloden were then the very same people used to massacre the indigenous peoples of Canada and North America. There was no solidarity there in Australia either, where they entirely genocided the entire Aboriginal population. Scots were often at the centre of doing that. Scots were there in Africa too. We are perpetrators. We have to just accept that we're not this plucky little oppressed nation. We are a perpetrator nation, which has lost the memory. We've had an organised forgetting about our past as a colonial power. So if we become an independent country, which I think we inevitably will, there's a bunch of Caribbean countries called CARICOM, the Caribbean Community, and they have, 11 of them have sued the 7 European nations, including the UK, through the United Nations, for reparative justice. If we become an independent country, we will be the 8th. And our friends in the Caribbean have warned us that we will be. So we better come to terms with this and make a decision. And part of our independence referendum actually is going to be, what will be our reparative justice act to those countries we've exploited and benefited from, particularly in West Africa and the Caribbean? What are we going to do to help develop their societies, their economies, their health services, their education services, to bring them up to a decent level? We should say, remember, that we've benefited from them losing their skilled people. Think of the 700,000 nurses that have come from Jamaica alone in the last 70 years, I should say. The UK health services massively benefiting that. You go to the Jamaican health services, they have no nurses. They haven't got enough nurses and doctors. So we should be, at least paying for the training of the replacements. Remember, Jamaican taxpayers have paid for that. West African taxpayers, South African taxpayers have paid for these nurses to come here. Filipino taxpayers have paid for them. And yet we paid not a cent for their training. So we must stop exploiting. We're still exploiting these countries now. So let's have a different, more equal relationship with it. If we're going to be independent, we need to have a fresh start. We need to obviously end the empire, and we will do that by breaking away. But we need to have a proper look at how we relate to the resources of these countries and what kind of equal exchange and relationship we're going to have with them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What are some of the things that could be done? I mean, I completely agree, and I hadn't really seen things those way. I guess I've always had this kind of vision as Scotland was being kind of dragged along in the imperial enterprise of the UK, but not really realizing the degree to which it benefited as well. So we've only got a couple minutes to, we need to wrap it up. But in closing, what are some more concrete things that Scotland can do as an independent nation to come to terms with that and recognize itself for the role it's played and make atonement for that?
I think we should immediately launch a public inquiry into institutionalized racism and the slavery and colonial legacy of the country. And we should do it in the same way as at the same scale as a Truth and Reconciliation Commission, something like that, to fundamentally change the curriculum in our schools, what we tell ourselves in our history books, and in removing the institutionalized barriers to racism in our public institutions and in employment. We should pass new equalities legislation to enforce the private sector to properly abide by racial relations anti-discrimination law. So I think there are things we could say that the Scottish state will do differently after independence. And we should announce that prior and during the referendum. Mm-hmm. So that African people in particular, but also all the BME communities, have something positive they know will happen if Scotland becomes an independent country.
Okay, well, I think we need to conclude, but it was a real pleasure to have you and for this inaugural version of episode of Building the Scottish State. And I did this in a spirit of really wanting to start the conversation about how things could be different. And I can't think of a more poignant person to begin this conversation. So thank you very much for being with us. And
Mark, if I may say one last thing, is that I want to remind people to support and join the Sheku Bio Justice campaign. If you look on the SEC site, you can see there's their new campaign is launched this weekend called, you know, under the hashtag Bio Justice. So if you look that up, you can help refund the campaign. The public inquiry that that Hamza Yusuf has called is likely to be in November. November has St. Andrew's Anti-Racism Day on November the 30th. That's likely to be a very large demonstration in support of Sheku Bio, and I want to see the independence movement there to make sure that justice comes for that family.
Okay, on that note, thank you very much, Graham, for being with us, and hope to have you back again very soon.
You're welcome, Mark. Thank you.